shorts instead. Surprised, she pulled back. She was fanatic about her desk. Her first year in Deer Lake, Phoebe had given her a plaque for Christmas that read, "Persons moving objects on this desk will be prosecuted to the full extent of the law." It resided in its usual spot, at the front edge of the blotter. The stacks of papers and files were neat, but not quite where she had left them. All pens were in their tooled leather cup, but the cup was 6 inches out of place. "Must have been someone new on the cleaning staff," she rationalized as she moved the reports and unearthed the coaster. But as she shrugged out of her coat and hung it on the rack in the corner, that smoky drawl whispered in the back of her mind. "Assumptions can be very dangerous things. Your boss needs to have a word with someone about security." A shiver skittered like a bony fingertip down the back of her neck. "Things have taken quite an interesting turn, haven't they, Ms. North?"
Ellen wheeled around. He stood just inside the door. The light coming through the window was gray and grainy. It suited him, playing on the angles of his face. He hadn't bothered to shave, looked, in fact, as if he had yet to go to bed.
"How did you get in here?"
A smile quirked one corner of a mouth that would have looked perfect on a high-priced hooker and was somehow sexier on him.
"The door was open."
Ellen went on the offensive.
"See this?" she asked, curling her hand into a fist and raising it. "Around here, it's customary to make one of these and strike it against a door or doorframe prior to entering another person's home or office. We call it knocking."
"I'll try to remember that," Brooks commented, strolling away from her.
He started on a slow circuit of the cramped room, absorbing the details of it. The framed diplomas, the well-tended plant on the credenza, the small CD player, a neat rack of CDs nestled in among the law tomes in the bookcase. Everything neat and tidy, like Ellen North herself. Not a hair out of place, literally. Her hair was swept back flawlessly into a slick, no-nonsense twist his fingers itched to pull loose.
"Can I help you, Mr. Brooks?"
Her tone was acid with sarcasm.
"I came to make an appointment."
"I have an assistant for that. And before you bypassed her desk, you walked past our receptionist, who could also have taken care of you. You actually could have saved yourself a trip. We do have telephones."
"They're ringing off their hooks today."
He watched her from the corner of his eye as he circled around behind her desk. She clearly didn't like him trespassing. She stood with her arms crossed over the front of her smart charcoal suit, her lips pressed into a thin line, her gray eyes narrowed slightly. He could tell she was building up a fine head of steam, and yet she kept it contained inside the pretty, polished exterior.
"I understand the boy showed up last night."
"His name is Josh."
"Reappeared like magic, I'm told."
"Told by whom?" He chose not to answer. Looking away from her, he noticed the crystal candy dish on the upper right-hand corner of the desk, filled with polite little after-dinner mints in pastel colors. He fished out a green one and met her eyes again as he placed it on his tongue.
"The bond hearing is this morning."
Ellen had to force her gaze away from his mouth, but jerking it upward was a mistake, because there were his eyes, watchful, unblinking, amused. Picking up her briefcase, she skirted around him. "Yes, the bond hearing is this morning. I'm very busy. If you'd care to make an appointment, stop and do so on your way out." Jay ignored the dismissal. He surrendered the space behind the desk and sauntered back to the bookcase, scanning the titles of her CD collection. Quiet, orderly music. Mozart, Vivaldi, New Age artists. Philip Auberg, William Ackerman. Background music. Nothing that could distract her from her work. Nothing that could hint at the woman behind that cool control. The lack of clues only served to intrigue him further.
"You can call me Jay," he offered.
"I can also call security and have you thrown out."
The threat bounced off.
"Think he'll make bail?"
"Not if I have anything to say about it."
She settled herself in her chair and slipped on a pair of scholarly-looking reading glasses. If her intent was to hide or tone down her femininity, she failed miserably.
The spectacles were more a counterpoint to her looks than a cover. He could imagine leaning across that neat desk and sliding them off her face or kissing her and watching her surprise as they fogged up. He had the most devilish urge to rattle her. But he would keep it in check, at least for the moment. He was already pushing his luck with her, though he could have argued that was a vital part of the process. He wanted to know more about her. She wasn't the kind of woman who offered those insights freely. On the other hand, it would be essential for him to have her cooperation if he decided to make this case his next bestseller. It had all the ingredients: a fascinating criminal, sympathetic victims, a setting that would draw readers in, a crime with complications, twists, the extras, the side stories that elevated it above the level of news story. Most of all, it had captured his attention as nothing had in a long time. He didn't yet know what approach he would take, or even if he would do it. All he really knew at this point was that he wanted to know more, that he needed the distraction. Badly. He eased himself down into the visitor's chair.
"He stays in the can. It shortens your prep time for the probable cause hearing."
"I'm not concerned." Picking up a purple glass paperweight from atop a stack of reports, he curled his hand around it as if it were a baseball, and he was fixing to throw a slider. The slider was a great pitch, his personal favorite. It looked as if it were going one way, then exploded in another.
"You could set a reachable bail," he suggested. "Buy yourself a little time."
Her eyebrows rose above the rims of her glasses. "And release a kidnapper? A man who brutally assaulted a police officer? You must be insane."
"He allegedly committed those crimes. What happened to the presumption of innocence? It's for jurors and fools. And if you quote me on that, I'll sue your ass 8 ways from Sunday. I'm not about to let Garrett Wright out of jail." "What's he gonna do if he gets out?" Jay needled. "Steal another kid? I don't think so. He's smarter than that. If he's your man at all. He's our man. So who brought Josh home?"
Ellen bit down on her reply. He was baiting her, and she was sitting here and taking it. Here, in her own office. What the hell was he doing here anyway? Pumping her for information as if he had a personal stake in the case, as if he were Wright's attorney. Denny Enberg should have been sitting in that chair making that same argument. She glanced at the message slips to see if any of them bore the name of Wright's attorney. None did. "Other than dispensing unsolicited advice, do you have a purpose for bothering me, Mr. Brooks?" The pirate grin stretched across his mouth.
"I bother you, Ms. North? Why is that?"
"It could have something to do with the fact that you're an extremely annoying person." He splayed a hand across his chest.
"Who? Me? Time magazine said I'm loved by millions."
"So is McDonald's, but you won't find me eating there. I'm a woman of discriminating taste." The grin curled into a smile that was nothing short of feral. He came out of the chair and leaned across the desk, planting his hands on her blotter.
"I can see that you are, Ms. North,"
he said in a voice like black velvet.
"A woman of incomparable style and taste. Sharp-tongued. Sharp-witted. Makes me wonder what you're doing in a nowhere place, in a nothing job like this."
Ellen resisted the urge to grab her letter opener and stab him with it. For all the satisfaction it would have brought, she had to prepare for court and didn't have time to deal with a mess. She met his gaze with a cool look as she rose slowly from her chair to take away his dramatic height advantage. "I don't have to justify my life to you, nor do I have to put up with you, Mr. Brooks. If you're here because you want to do a book about this case, I have no intention of cooperating. I'm asking you to leave. I suggest you do so, or I will call security. And won't that do wonders for your image as a beloved personality? Front-page photos of you being physically removed from these offices." Instead of the expected show of bad temper, he stood back and regarded her with a look that suggested he was proud of her. Ellen wanted to throw something at him.
"I look forward to watching you in court, Ms. North.
I'll make that appointment on my way out. As he strolled out, it seemed as if all the energy in the room went with him. Feeling limp, Ellen sank back down onto her chair. Phoebe burst into the office, eyes as big as saucers, her cheeks glowing. She shut the door and pressed back against it.
"Oh, my God!" she gasped. "I'm in love!"
"Again?" She swept into a chair, perching on the edge of it.
"Do you know who was just in here?"
"Jay Butler Brooks."
"Jay Butler Brooks! He is such a babe! He was number 17 on People magazine's list of the 20 most intriguing people of the year."
She brought herself up short, out of breath, her brows drawing together as the obvious dawned on her belatedly.
"What was he doing in here?"
"Annoying me," Ellen groused, digging through her briefcase for the complaint forms against Wright. "You forgot pain in the butt in your tribute."
"I'm not even going to try to turn that into a sexual reference," Phoebe said. "Suffice it to say, I would sit still and let him annoy me all day long if I could just look at him."
"Phoebe, you amaze me," Ellen complained, scanning the pages of the document. "You're an intelligent, articulate, educated woman, panting after a man who
is a total hot babe. Intelligence and hormones are not mutually exclusive, Ellen. You should remember that."
"What's that supposed to mean?" Phoebe refrained from comment, trooping to the door in her clunky boots.
"He made an appointment to see you later. Is he interested in the case? Is he going to write a book?"
"I don't know, and I don't want to know," Ellen said stubbornly. "Cancel the appointment. I'm sure I have something more important to do at that time."
"I don't think you'll want to cancel,"
her secretary warned. "And why is that?"
"He's bringing the state attorney general with him."
Surely no bond hearing in the history of Park County, Minnesota, had ever attracted so much attention. The courtroom was full. Observers packed on the benches like sardines in a tin. Jay stayed at the back of the mob, timing his entrance so attention would be focused away from him. Wearing a baseball cap pulled low over his shades, he slipped in and took a spot on the aisle. The reporters leaped to their feet, craning their necks for a better look at Garrett Wright as he made his entrance with his attorney. Wright and his lawyer were flanked by a deputy and the Park County Sheriff himself, Russ Steiger. Another politician in search of a photo op. No sheriff would ever have lowered himself to escorting prisoners unless he hoped to gain something from the visibility of the case. Wright wasn't even Steiger's bust. According to the Minneapolis Star Tribune, Steiger's bust was a 36C who went by the name of Paige Price and didn't mind playing a little horizontal hokey-pokey to get her story for the Channel 7 News. Ellen North and her associate Reed had already taken their seats at the prosecution's table. She didn't look up as Wright entered the courtroom, as if she couldn't be bothered to give him the least consideration. She kept her attention on the papers she was idly reviewing, glancing up only when the judge emerged from his chambers. Everyone in the room rose on command as the Honorable Victor Franken took the bench. Franken was small and bald and misshapen, with an unhealthy yellow cast to his skin. He looked like a 100-year-old hand puppet in his long black robe, like Yoda from Star Wars. He banged his gavel and banged it again, looking secretly pleased at the way people jumped reflexively at the sound.
"This is the state versus Dr. Garrett Wright," he croaked, his voice rusted by age. "Who am I dealing with here?"
He squinted at the defense, as if he hadn't just spent half an hour in chambers with the lawyers involved, and grumbled,
"Dennis Enberg,"
then turned his wizened countenance on the prosecution.
"Ellen North. Who's that with you?"
he barked, and pulled his pince-nez off the withered red nub of his nose, then rubbed them against his robe.
"Assistant County Attorney Cameron Reed, Your Honor,"
Reed said loudly, rising halfway from his chair. Franken waved Ellen's associate back to his seat.
"Let's have it, Miss North."
Wright and his lawyer were officially served with a complaint. Jay smiled to himself. Good move, Ms. North. Having the complaint presented now meant it had to be read aloud into the record. The clerk of the court, a matronly sort who likely had a brood of children of her own, read the charges, one after another. Kidnapping, denying parental rights, kidnapping a police officer, and causing great bodily harm, attempted homicide, assault, assault, assault. Enough counts and variations of assault to sound as if Wright had attacked half the town. While she did her best to keep the emotion from her voice, the clerk couldn't seem to keep her throat from tightening or her eyes from shooting daggers at the defendant as she read the bit about the blood-stained sheet that had been wrapped around Megan O'Malley, bloodstains that matched Josh Kirkwood's blood type. Round one went to the prosecution. The members of the media soaked it all in. The allegations stacked one on top of another. Mitch Holt's report of the events that had taken place Saturday night, up to and including the chase and Wright's apprehension. The defense was allowed to make no rebuttal. Enberg sat scratching the arm of his wool jacket, looking as if he were fighting a losing battle with acid indigestion. When the clerk finished reading, Franken fixed the accused with a baleful stare.
Dr. Wright, do you understand the charges being made against you?
Yes, Wright said softly.
Don't mumble. Yes, Your Honor. I want you to know that in the eyes of the court, you are innocent until the state proves your guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
The glare seemed to suggest otherwise, but then it could have been cataracts or constipation causing the judge's sour expression.
You will have the opportunity to plead guilty or not guilty. You'll have the right to a trial. If there's a trial, you will have the right to hear the state's evidence, to cross-examine the state's witnesses, and to present witnesses of your own. You may testify on your own behalf, or remain silent. You already have a lawyer, so we don't need to talk about that. Did you get all that?
Franken shouted.
Yes, Your Honor.
Ellen rose. Jay leaned to the right for a better look down the aisle. Even through the bars of the gate that kept the spectators at bay, he caught a nice glimpse of leg. She never cast a glance at the gallery, giving the impression that they meant nothing to her. Her only interest was her job, to bring the hobnailed boot of justice down squarely on Garrett Wright's head. Based on the complaint and the statements of the officers involved, Your Honor, the state requests the defendant be booked and a date set for the omnibus hearing.
The purpose of the omnibus hearing, Dr. Wright, Franken explained, is to hear all issues that can be determined before trial, evidentiary issues, pre-trial motions, and determine whether or not there is probable cause to bind you over for trial.
Franken drew a wheezing breath to replenish his withered lungs and fell into a coughing fit, nearly disappearing behind the bench as he hunched over. Everyone in the room seemed to hold a breath, waiting for his tuft of cotton-white hair to vanish as he crumpled to the floor in a small dead heap. The bailiff peered around the edge of the massive bench. Franken popped up again, like a moldy jack-in-the-box, and made an impatient gesture at his clerk.
"Omnibus hearing on Tuesday, February 1st?" she suggested.
"Let's see about the bail."
"Your Honor, in view of the seriousness of the charges," Ellen said, "the state requests bail in the amount of $1 million. A gasp went up from the gallery. Pens scrambled frantically across paper. The murmur of voices into mini-cassette recorders was like the low hum of an engine. Franken banged his gavel. Enberg hopped up from his chair.
"Your Honor, that's outrageous. My client is a professor at one of the top private colleges in the country. He works with juvenile offenders. He is a well-respected member of this community."
"Who happens to be charged with heinous crimes?" Franken said.
"He has ties to the community, and the charges are ludicrous."
"And he was apprehended after a lengthy chase. Save it for the hearing, Dennis," Franken ordered. "He's a flight risk. I'm setting bail in the amount of $500,000 cash. Omnibus hearing on the...
He shook a crooked finger at his clerk.
"Whatever Renee said.
Tuesday, February 1st.
The defendant shall be booked, photographed, and fingerprinted," Franken stated,
and he shall undergo a physical exam for scratches, bruises, etc., and surrender samples of blood and hair for analysis and comparison with evidence.
He cracked the gavel again, signaling the end of the proceedings. The reporters jumped up and scrambled over one another to get to the door, or to get to the lawyers, or Paul Kirkwood, who had positioned himself directly behind the prosecutors. Jay eased out of his seat and took a position at the back of the pack.
"He should rot in jail," Kirkwood said, "after what he put my son through, after what he put us all through."
"If Garrett Wright is guilty, then who returns Josh? Has your son identified Garrett Wright as his kidnapper? Is there any truth to the rumor the police are still considering you a suspect?" Kirkwood's face flushed. His eyes were bright with temper.
"I had nothing to do with my son's disappearance. I am 100% innocent. Any accusation to the contrary is just another example of the incompetence of the Deer Lake Police Department."
"Let's break it up, folks," the white-haired bailiff called. "We've got business to conduct in this courtroom."
As the circus moved out into the hall, Jay took a seat, keeping his head down as he jotted notes and avoided recognition. As much as he enjoyed his fame and fortune, there was something to be said for anonymity, particularly now. The case had drawn him here. He wanted to be able to take it all in, without the interference discovery would bring. Unfortunately, he wasn't going to be able to get the kind of access he wanted without using his name like a pry bar. He took one last look at Ellen North, who sat in conference with her associate at the prosecution's table. He speculated as to what he might get there besides a hot tongue and a cold shoulder. A challenge, some insight, a kick in the ego. He knew what he wanted, and he could guarantee it she wouldn't give it to him without a fight.
Chapter 6.
"The goddamn lawyers strike again. I can't believe that bitch asked for $1 million bail. $1 million, shit. Ms. North was only doing her job," Christopher Priest said.
He stood at the front of the classroom, a small man with big glasses and bad taste in clothes. His students sometimes teased him about perpetuating the stereotypical image of computer people as nerds, but their comments and suggestions went unheeded. There were certain advantages to the image. Unfounded assumptions could be useful things.
"Her job," Tyrell Mann jeered.
Even his posture was disrespectful. He sprawled back in his chair with his long arms crossed over the front of his Chicago Bulls starter jacket.
"Her job is to fucking pin this on somebody. Fucking cops would have nailed a brother for it, but there ain't hardly no niggers in this fucking hick town."
"That's not logical, Tyrell," Priest said, unaffected by the bravado or the language. He had helped found the Sci-Fi Cowboys. Even though there had been encouragement to expand the program, they kept it at a manageable level. 10 young men from Minneapolis inner-city schools, teenagers whose brushes with the law ran the gamut from gang activity to grand theft auto. The point of the program was to bring the boys' positive qualities of intelligence to the surface, to interest them in science and engineering through innovative projects with computers and robotics. The boys had requested this emergency meeting, a logistical headache that required a dozen phone calls to schools to get permission for the boys to leave in the middle of the day, and to probation officers to find one willing to drive them down to Deer Lake. At least the van simplified matters somewhat. Fundraising and contributions had helped pay for a used Ford van 4 years ago.
"Think," Priest said, "if the authorities were looking for a scapegoat, would they choose a man like Dr. Wright?" "Hell no. But that loser they dragged in from the hockey rink offed himself."
J.R. Anderson leaned forward in his seat. His rap sheet included charges for raiding bank accounts electronically.
"Professor, are you saying it is logical to believe Dr. Wright did it?"
The others in the group reacted in an explosion of sound. Priest waited for the fury to die down.
"Of course not. I'm asking you to look at the system without emotion coloring your perceptions. The police apprehended someone they believed to be involved in the crime."
He held up a finger to ward off the automatic protests,
You are all well aware that the next step in the process belongs to the county attorney's office. It's Ms. North's job, fucking bitch. Tyrell
unfolded his long arms and spread them wide.
A million?
A lesson in bargaining. Always ask for more than you think you can get. The judge cut that number in half.
500 large. Where are we supposed to raise that kind of green?
I'm sure Dr. Wright will appreciate your intentions, Priest said. But no one expects you guys to raise that kind of money.
I could get it,
J.R. offered with a twisted grin, cracking his knuckles with dramatic flair. The professor ignored the inference. Crime was never rewarded within the group in any way, not even as a joke.
If you want to show your support, there are things you can do. You've got brains. Use them.
Our name, J.R. said, his gaze sharp on the professor.
We're a media draw.
Very good, J.R. We could start a defense fund for the doc.
And the news crews will hear about it and make a big deal about us.
And the money will come rolling in. A knock at the door drew Priest's attention away from the conversation. Professor? Ellen North inched the door open. I'm sorry to disturb you. I was told you didn't have a class this hour.
I don't.
He stepped into the hall and closed the door behind him. The cowboys called an emergency meeting. They were understandably upset over Dr. Wright's arrest. Then they heard the news reports of this morning's bail hearing. He offered a little shrug that sent his shrunken wool sweater crawling up his midriff. You have to understand, they're not very trusting of the system.
Ellen reserved comment. From her perspective, the system wasn't the problem with juvenile offenders, but she hadn't come to Harris College for a philosophical argument.
She wanted to meet and speak with Wright's friends and colleagues herself, face to face, to look for some hint of doubt or unease in them. It seemed impossible that Wright could be so twisted without giving someone close to him a clue. But wasn't that what everyone in Deer Lake wanted to think? That a monster had to look like a monster, and walk like a monster, and talk like a monster, so they could see the monster coming? If evil came in plain clothes and a pretty face, then evil could be anyone, anywhere.
I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about the night Josh Kirkwood disappeared, she said. It won't take long, but if you'd rather I come back. I heard he's been returned unharmed.
Priest raised a bony hand to rub his chin.
A fascinating turn of events. Obviously, Dr. Wright didn't return the child. Not that I believe Garrett took Josh in the first place.
We believe otherwise, Professor. He put his head a little on one side and looked at her as if he were an android, attempting to decipher the illogical workings of the human mind.
Do you truly believe, or are you following a path of least resistance?
Believe me, prosecuting a well-respected member of the community is hardly a path of least resistance.
However, he is the bird in the hand, so to speak.
Just because there's still one in the bush doesn't mean this one isn't guilty, Ellen pointed out. Priest just blinked at her, frowning the way he probably frowned at students who couldn't grasp the latest computer language. I want to clarify a couple of points about last night, she said. You told the police you were here working.
In the computer center, yes. Garrett and I have a group of students working together on a project involving learning and perception. One of those students was here with me.
Mike Chamberlain, Ellen said, whom you sent on an errand around 5 o'clock, an errand he never accomplished because he was involved in a car accident.
That's correct.
The accident that kept Hannah Garrison at the hospital when she would have been picking Josh up from the hockey rink. Priest looked down at his loafers.
Yes, he said softly. If I hadn't sent Mike out at that precise moment, perhaps none of this would have happened. You can't imagine how that makes me feel. I think the world of Hannah. It was such a relief to hear she'd got Josh back, unharmed.
The professor's cheeks colored as he spoke of Hannah Garrison. Interesting. And a little odd. He didn't seem the sort for romantic crushes. Or perhaps the shy glance at his shoes was something else altogether. Megan O'Malley didn't believe that car accident had been an accident at all, but rather the first move in the kidnapper's game.
Was the involvement of Priest's student in that car wreck accidental, or was that all part of the plan as well? If one professor could be involved, why not two? After Mike Chamberlain left, you were here alone? Priest's eyes narrowed a fraction. His skinny shoulders pulled back.
I thought I was past needing an alibi, Ms. North. I voluntarily took a lie detector test on Sunday.
I'm aware of that, Professor, Ellen said without apology. Did you see Dr. Wright here that evening?
No. I wish I could say I did, but I was in the machine room in the computer center, and Garrett was in his office.
So he claims.
Only the guilty live their lives with alibis in mind.
You and Dr. Wright are friends. You work together. Founded the Sci-Fi Cowboys together. You don't happen to jointly own any property, do you? A cabin, maybe?
We're friends and colleagues, Ms. North, not husband and wife.
The door behind him opened, and a tall youth with angry dark eyes glared out over the professor's head.
You got a problem here, Professor?
No, Tyrell, there's no problem,
Priest said evenly. Tyrell kept his gaze fixed hard on Ellen.
Hey, you that bitch lawyer.
Tyrell... Priest turned and attempted to contain the trouble to the classroom, an effort as futile as trying to shove the cork back in a champagne bottle. The door swung wide, and two more members of the Sci-Fi Cowboys stared out, arrogant and indignant, and big enough to pick their mentor up and set him aside like a child.
Dr. Wright is innocent. He's gonna kick your ass in court. Guys, please go back to your seats,
Priest ordered. They stared past him as if he were invisible, their attention on the woman who was, in their minds, an enemy. Ellen held her ground. She had tried enough hardened criminals of 16 and 17 to know the rules. Show no fear. Show no emotion. With hormones at high tide, the kids had enough emotion for everyone, all of it negative, ready to boil up into violence.
Dr. Wright will have his chance to prove his innocence in court.
Yeah, right.
Court didn't give me a chance. Court screwed my ass.
Priest frowned at her.
You've got your hands full, Professor.
Ellen said. I'll let you go. If anything occurs to you that may be of help to the case, please call me or Chief Holt.
When hell freezes over, bitch!
The one called Tyrell shouted as she turned and walked away. The neighborhood to the south of the Harris College campus had once been a town in its own right. Harrisburg had competed with Deer Lake for commerce and population during the latter part of the 19th century. But Deer Lake had won the railroad and the title of county seat, and Harrisburg had lost its identity. At some point, what was left of it had been annexed by the Deer Lake municipality, and someone had slapped it with a nickname, Dinky Town. The old buildings on the main drag housed businesses that targeted the college crowd. The buildings were shabby, but the signs were trendy and artsy. The clip-joint hair and tanning salon, the tome bookstore, the leaning tower of pizza, Green World, a nature and new age shop, the Leaf and Bean Coffee House, a mix of bars, restaurants, and tiny art galleries. Ellen headed for an old creamery building on the north end. The Pack Rat was a second-hand shop crammed with a boggling array of junk. Racks of vintage clothes from the 60s and 70s crowded the front of the room. A hand-lettered sign above them read, Blast from the Past. Ellen scowled at the thought that anything she might have worn in high school was now considered nostalgic. She worked her way back through the haphazard displays of outdated textbooks and Harris mementos that alumni had undoubtedly trucked out of their basements and attics to make room for more timely junk. The clerk behind the counter was a large girl, with a shock of purple hair, black eyeshadow, and a ruby stud in the side of her nose. She was engaged in animated conversation with a tall young man, as slender as a rope, stoop-shouldered and rusty-haired. He wore the scraggly chin whiskers that passed for a beard with the grunge crowd and sucked on a cigarette with serious purpose. The pair of them caught sight of Ellen simultaneously and gave her the kind of look that suggested they were more interested in making small talk than money.
"I'm looking for Todd Childs," Ellen said. "I'm Todd."
He tapped the ash off his cigarette into a tin ashtray with a plastic hula dancer perched on the rim. "Ellen North, I'm with the county attorney's office. I'd like to have a few minutes of your time if I could." He took a last, deep drag, crushed the cigarette out, and blew the smoke out of his nostrils on a sigh of disgust.
I was just leaving. I got a class in half an hour.
It won't take long. She watched his face as he weighed the merits of denying her. He exchanged a look with Vampira behind the counter. Behind his round-rimmed glasses, his pupils were dilated, large, ink-black spots rimmed by thin lines of color. Steiger called him a pothead. The scent that underscored the cigarette smoke on him was unmistakable. But smoking a little grass was a long way from being an accessory to the kind of crimes Garrett Wright had committed.
"Clock's ticking," she said with a phony smile.
Todd heaved another sigh.
"All right, fine. Let's go back in the office."
He led the way through the maze to a room the size of a broom closet, where he took a seat between piles of junk on the desk. The only chair was a dirty green beanbag. Ellen gave it a dubious glance and leaned a shoulder against the doorframe. Wright's student jumped on the offensive.
"The charges against Dr. Wright are so bogus."
The police caught him fleeing the scene. He shook his head, fishing in the pocket of his flannel shirt for another Marlboro.
"No way. It was some kind of frame job or something."
"You know Dr. Wright that well?"
"I'm a psych major," he said,
cigarette bobbing on his lip. "I've spent the last 2 years of my life immersed in the workings of the human mind."
"So are you the next Sigmund Freud or the next Carl Jung?"
He kept his eyes on her as he lit up and took the first drag.
"Freud was a pervert. Garrett Wright is not."
"I admire your loyalty, Todd, but I'm afraid it's misplaced." He shook his head, his stubbornness manifesting itself in the set of his mouth, a tight hyphen encircled by the ratty goatee.
"He would have to be a total sociopath to do what you say he did."
"No way. We would have known."
"Isn't that part of sociopathic behavior? The ability to fool the people around you into thinking you're perfectly normal?"
The cigarette came up in a hand that wasn't quite steady. He took another puff and looked away.
"You realize there's a strong possibility you'll be called to testify at the hearing next week," Ellen said.
"Oh, man." "You were with Dr. Wright Saturday morning when Agent O'Malley came to his office. You were a part of the conversation when Dr. Wright and Agent O'Malley were discussing her driving out to Christopher Priest's home. You told the police you left Dr. Wright's office around 1:15 and didn't see Dr. Wright again that day. You'll have to say that in court."
He banded one arm around his skinny midsection as if he had suddenly developed a stomachache.
"Fuck."
"The truth is the truth, Todd," Ellen murmured, caught between sympathy and suspicion. Was he reluctant because Wright was his mentor, or because Wright was his partner in crime, and he now saw the whole thing unraveling around them?
"Think of it this way. You won't actually be testifying against Dr. Wright. It's not as if you saw him commit a crime. Is it, Todd?"
His answer was a long time coming. He stared at the wall, at a magic eye calendar that looked as if someone had squirted out ketchup and mustard in no discernible pattern. Ellen wondered if he saw the hidden picture. She didn't. Only the guilty knew the secret. Only the guilty could see the pattern through the chaos.
"No," he said at last. "I'll let you get to that class."
She straightened from the door and started to turn, then looked back at him. "Can you tell me where you were last night around midnight?"
"In bed? Alone?"
He tossed his half-finished cigarette into an abandoned coffee cup.
"Where were you?"
She faked a smile. "One of the perks of the job. I get to ask all the questions." The scent of smoke lingered on her coat. Ellen sniffed at a lapel and frowned as she wound her way through the outer office to Phoebe's desk.
"Shouldn't your generation be smart enough not to smoke cigarettes?" she complained.
"Yes, but we're largely without focus and grounded in the disillusionment of the time, so..."
She shrugged, screwing her pixie face into a look of apology.
"Be sure Todd Childs gets a subpoena. And please call Mitch and tell him if he brings Childs in for questioning again, I want to watch."
"Gotcha."
Like a kaleidoscope image, Phoebe's features rearranged themselves again, blooming into a look of excitement.
"You've got a full house," she said,
hooking a thumb in the direction of Ellen's office.
Realization dawned with a sick thud in her stomach. Appointment time. Oh, God, she groaned. I must have led a very wicked past life.
I'd like to lead a wicked present life, Phoebe said. You could pass that information along to Mr. Gorgeous Blue Eyes if you'd like.
Ellen shook her head and let herself into her office. The room seemed much too small for the size of the egos present. She had the wild feeling that if she opened the window to alleviate the pressure, she would be sucked out and dumped in the snow 2 stories down. Sorry I'm late, she said, setting her briefcase down and shrugging out of her coat. I've got a lot of legwork to do before the hearing next week.
You couldn't make Reed do it?
Rudy groused. I'm lead prosecutor. I damn well better know who I'm dealing with. Brooks smiled at her, the kind of secret knowing smile lovers share. Ellen scowled at him and took her seat behind the desk.
We understand perfectly, Ellen,
Bill Glendenning said magnanimously. The state attorney general sat in one visitor's chair. The eyes behind the spectacles could easily have been mistaken for kind, but she knew better. Bill Glendenning was a shrewd man with a taste for power. She admired and respected him, but was careful to temper that admiration with common sense. He was at the top of the food chain. He hadn't gotten there by being benevolent. Rudy hovered behind him, too wired to sit down, even if there had been a chair available for him. Unable to contain his excitement at having Glendenning in the offices 2 days running, he paced, his face glowing with zeal, or a fever. He pulled a rumpled handkerchief out of his pants pocket and dabbed at his forehead.
I'm sure I don't need to tell you, Ellen. We have a very unusual situation in this case,
Glendenning said in a fatherly voice.
No, you don't need to tell me.
She resented the Ward Cleaver Act, but she was careful to keep that resentment out of her reply. Instead, she rose from her chair to counteract the idea that she was a child to be lectured. Keeping every move casual, she stepped around the end of her desk and leaned a hip against it, standing with her arms crossed loosely.
The abduction itself was an aberration,
Glendenning went on.
Things like that don't happen in Deer Lake, or so we all like to think. The fact that it did happen here has drawn the focus of the nation. They see it as a metaphor for our times. Isn't that so, Jay?
Jay blinked at the sound of his name, breaking the trance he had fallen into staring at Ellen North's legs. The lady had a fine set of pegs on her, infinitely more worthy of his attention than Bill Glendenning's pointless pontificating. The Attorney General was in this for himself, pure and simple. He was well aware that Jay's name was currently white-hot, and like any politician, Bill Glendenning would gladly bask in the warmth if he could. He wanted a piece of the action, all of the credit, and as much publicity as he could grab, a metaphor for our times.
That's a fact, sir.
Jay nodded.
It's a story bigger than Deer Lake, bigger than all of us,
Glendenning went on, shamelessly plagiarizing the words Jay had dazzled him with 2 nights ago over whiskey and cigars.
Ellen, you understand that, which is part of the reason Rudy entrusted you with this case.
Rudy beamed at the mention of his name, an expression that crashed in the next instant.
I was taught to put cases on even ground, Ellen said. I won't approach this case any differently because of the circumstances or because the man who stands accused is someone no one would have suspected.
Impatience flashed behind Glendenning's Roosevelt glasses. I'm doing my job, Ellen went on calmly. My job is to put away Garrett Wright. I can't afford to lose my focus on that end or be distracted by a bigger picture. I can't stop people from taking an interest in this case or dissecting it as a metaphor for our times. But I can't let that become a part of my agenda. Rudy was turning burgundy from his throat up. He stood behind Glendenning, his eyes bugging out as if he were being choked.
But Ellen is absolutely right,
Jay drawled, smiling inwardly at the reactions. Ellen's look was wary. Glendenning scrambled to regroup. Behind him, Rudy Stovich pretended a coughing fit.
Lady Justice is blind, not looking to get her good side in front of the camera.
My point exactly,
Glendenning said, leaning over toward Jay like a buddy on a bar stool. This is precisely why Ellen is the one to try this case.
That's why I chose her,
Rudy interjected, hooking a finger inside his collar and tugging at the figurative noose around his neck.
I knew from the start she was the one for the job.
Ellen checked her watch instead of rolling her eyes. Forgive my bluntness, but I have to be in court soon. What does any of this have to do with Mr. Brooks? His blue eyes twinkled with suppressed amusement. One corner of his mouth kicked up. He sat with his legs stretched out in front of him and crossed at the ankles. He had made concessions for this meeting. The jeans and denim shirt had been traded in for a button-down blue Oxford and khakis. The parka had been replaced by a navy blazer, tailored to emphasize the set of his shoulders. But he still hadn't shaved, and his silk tie was loose at the throat. All in all, he looked as if he had been rolled by thugs on his way home from a Kayo mixer.
"As I'm sure you are well aware, Ellen," Glendenning said, "Mr. Brooks is a fixture in the ranks of true crime bestsellers. His abilities as an author speak for themselves."
"I'm sure they do," Ellen said dryly.
"Justifiable homicide," Rudy spouted, trying to wedge himself back into the conversation. "That's a personal favorite of mine."
Glendenning shot him a quelling look over his shoulder.
"We're all familiar with Mr. Brooks's work."
"Actually, I'm not," Ellen lied. "As a prosecutor, I find the growing mania for true crime disturbing and tawdry." She offered a smile of false apology to Jay. "No offense intended, Mr. Brooks." He rubbed a hand across his mouth to hide his grin.
"None taken, Ms. North."
Bill Glendenning's jaw tightened to the quality of granite. Behind him, Rudy looked horrified.
"Jay has taken an interest in this case," Glendenning said. "As a story that will touch the hearts and minds of people everywhere, he has expressed a particular interest in presenting it from our point of view."
Ellen stared at Jay Butler Brooks, disgust twisting inside her. He was sitting beside the state attorney general. Bill and Jay, best pals. Jay Butler Brooks, current darling of the media, a man with money, a man with clout in the publishing world and in Hollywood, a man people would trust just because they had read about him in People and Vanity Fair, and had come to the ridiculous conclusion that they knew him. Bill Glendenning, who would gladly use the publicity such an association would bring to help catapult himself into the governor's office. Slowly, she retreated back behind the desk on the excuse of sticking papers into her briefcase.
"Our point of view? What exactly is that supposed to mean?"
Brooks pushed himself up in his chair and leaned forward, his forearms on his thighs. Ellen could feel his gaze sharpen on her, but she refused to raise her eyes to meet his.
"A small-town justice system takes on a big-time case," he said. "The last bastion of decency in America assaulted by the poisonous evil of our modern society. This case has captured the attention and imagination of millions. I know it certainly intrigues me."
Ellen bit back a dozen scathing remarks. The case intrigued him, and if it intrigued him enough, he would capitalize on it. Suddenly the reporters who had been feeding off this tragedy seemed like small fish. The shark had just come into the waters. News was one thing. That Jay Butler Brooks would twist this into entertainment and make a fortune off it was reprehensible beyond words. She wanted to tell him so, but there he sat, with his good friend, the Attorney General, and her immediate boss hovering behind them, the nerd boy allowed to tag along with the cool guys because of his potential usefulness.
"What does this have to do with me?" she asked tightly.
"Oh, I am particularly intrigued by your role in all this, Ms. North," he said. "Prosecuting attorney, Ellen North, leading the charge for justice."
She jerked her head up and stared at him while every internal alarm system she had went off. His slow smile should have come complete with canary feathers sticking out the corners of his mouth.
"I'm just doing my job, Mr. Brooks. I'm not Joan of Arc."
That's all a matter of perspective.
Nevertheless, I'm not comfortable with the analogy.
Ellen, you're too modest, Glendenning said.
She was tempted to remind him that Joan had been burned at the stake, but there was the chance he already knew it. The implications of that made her vaguely queasy.
Jay has expressed an interest in following the case from the perspective of the prosecution, Glendenning said again. I've assured him you'll be accommodating.
Excuse me? Ellen gaped at Bill Glendenning. I'll be accommodating in what way?
Now, Ellen, he said, returning to that patronizing tone that set her teeth on edge, we're not suggesting anything unethical. Jay won't be privy to anything sensitive. He simply wants a chance to watch you work. He doesn't need our blessing to do that, but he asked for it anyway, as a courtesy.
As a courtesy that would get him into the good graces of the state attorney general, which would damn well guarantee him access. No, he didn't need permission to watch the case from afar, but stroking Glendenning would grease wheels no reporter could even venture near, and it put Ellen in the untenable position of having to act the gracious hostess, or run the risk of angering the powers that held the strings on her job. The complexity and diabolical qualities of this move hit a nerve inside her and ground on it like a stiletto heel. Her temper flared, and she clenched her jaw against the knee to let it go. She shut her briefcase slowly, deliberately, the click of each lock as loud as a gunshot in the silence of the room. She leveled a gaze on J. Butler Brooks that had turned better man to ashes. No, you obviously don't need my permission, Mr. Brooks, and it's a good thing, because I'd throw you out of here in a heartbeat. I'm due in court, she announced, with a cursory nod to Glendenning and Stovich. If you gentlemen will excuse me. She expected a reprimand, but none came as she walked out of the office. Or perhaps it was that she simply couldn't hear above the roar of her blood pressure in her ears. Phoebe jumped up from her desk, wide-eyed, abandoning Quentin Adler in mid-complaint.
Phoebe!
He wailed. She made a face at the grating sound, but ignored him, her attention on Ellen.
What did they want?
To make my life a living hell, Ellen snarled. The phrase attracted Quentin like a bell for Pavlov's dogs. A career grunt in the Park County system, Quentin was a man whose ambition overreached his abilities, a truth that left him with a perpetually bitter taste in his mouth. 50-something, he held himself stiffly erect, discouraged from relaxation and respiration by a super-control girdle that seemed to push all his fat up into his florid face. His latest affectation to battle the aging process was a dye job and permanent that left him looking as if he had a head covered with pubic hair. A transformation that coincided with rumors of a fling between Quentin and Janice Nairhaugen, a secretary in the county assessor's office.
Ellen, I have to speak with you about these cases you've dumped on me, he said.
I can't talk, Quentin. I've got to be in court. If you don't want them, talk to Rudy.
But Ellen...
Phoebe butted in front of him, pulling a handful of pink message slips out of a patch pocket on her tunic.
I've got messages for you. Every reporter in the Western Hemisphere wants an interview, and Garrett Wright has fired his attorney.
There's a big surprise, Ellen muttered. Denny Enberg's heart hadn't been in the case from the start. She wondered if Wright had truly fired him, or if he had withdrawn and allowed Wright to call it what he wanted, so as not to prejudice his case in the eyes of the press. She would call on Denny later to find out what she could, although she didn't expect to learn much. What went on between a client and his attorney was privileged. A severed relationship didn't change that. Any word on who's taking his place?
Not yet.
Phoebe lowered her voice conspiratorially.
He has a really volatile aura.
Who? Denny?
J. Butler Brooks. It suggests inner turbulence and raw sexuality.
Ellen, this is important, Quentin wailed. Tell that to Judge Franken when he cites me for contempt, Ellen said, handing the slips back to Phoebe. His aura suggests intolerance. I'm out of here. Chapter 7
Miss Bottoms, Judge Franken wheezed. Do you understand the charges against you?
Ellen had a suspicion much of life was a mystery
to Loretta Bottoms. The woman stood gaping at the judge like a beached bass, an exotic dancer whose stage name was Lotta Bottom. Loretta had been working the circuit of strip clubs along the interstate between Des Moines and Minneapolis. She claimed to have been working her way back home when she was arrested for soliciting at the Big Steer truck stop on the outskirts of Deer Lake. She stood before the court in a zebra-stripe knit dress that redefined the limitations of spandex. Built like an hourglass, tilting over on 4-inch heels, breasts heaved up into her décolletage like a pair of huge cling peaches. Franken was mesmerized by the sight. When he spoke, he addressed her breasts. Ellen figured he had as much chance of getting an intelligent answer from them as from any other part of Loretta.
"Miss Bottoms, have you discussed the charges with your attorney?"
the judge asked.
"Yeah. And?"
"And what?" Loretta sank a long red fingernail into her mare's nest of bleached hair to scratch her head.
"I don't get it."
Beside her, her attorney, Fred Nelson, rolled his eyes and banged a fist against the side of his head, as if trying to dislodge the rocks that would explain his having taken on Loretta as a client. "Loretta," he spoke to her as if she were a thick-headed child who had asked why 10 times too many. "We've heard the police report. The officer tells us he caught you in the men's room of the Big Steer truck stop performing a sex act with a $20 bill in your hand." Loretta jammed her hands on ample hips.
"I wasn't performing a sex act with a $20 bill. His name was Tater."
The spectators burst out laughing. Ellen bit the inside of her lip. Judge Franken banged his gavel. His whole misshapen little head turned maroon, a sign that his temper had been worn down to the nub and his blood pressure was soaring in direct proportion.
"How do you plead, Miss Bottoms?"
the judge demanded.
"Well, Freddy here tells me I gotta plead guilty, and I don't see why. It's nobody's business whose dick I had in my mouth."
Franken smashed his gavel down to quell the new wave of mirth.
"We've been through this 3 times, Miss Bottoms," he croaked,
trembling with frustration.
"You don't have to plead guilty if you don't want to. You can plead not guilty, but then you'll have to come back from Des Moines to stand trial. Do you want to stand trial?"
"Well, I don't really, but..."
"Then do you want to plead guilty?"
"No."
Fred Nelson squeezed his eyes shut. "Your Honor, I have been over this with my client. We discussed the possibility of Ms. Bottoms entering a plea of not guilty, the court setting a date for trial and bail in the vicinity of $250 cash. Then Ms. Bottoms can go home and give this matter some more thought." $250 was a usual fine for soliciting, and no one had any hope of or interest in Loretta Bottoms returning to Park County to stand trial. Ellen and Fred had hashed out the agreement in the judge's chambers. The county would get its money out of Loretta in the form of the forfeited cash bail when she failed to appear, and Loretta would be out of everyone's hair. It seemed a sweet deal to everyone but Loretta. The proceedings had already dragged on 30 minutes longer than they should have, because they couldn't state the deal outright in front of God and the court reporter, and the need for discretion had confused Loretta. Franken was sinking down farther behind the bench. In another minute, only his wrinkled forehead would be visible.
"Is that what you want to do, Miss Bottoms?"
he asked through his teeth. Loretta batted her false eyelashes.
"What?"
No one held back their groans, including Franken. His was the loudest. His head popped up, and he groaned again, louder, a look of surprise widening his tiny eyes. Then he disappeared from view altogether, a dull thump, the only clue he was behind the bench. For a moment, no one moved or spoke, as everybody waited for the judge to pop back up like a puppet. But the moment stretched into another. Ellen looked to the bailiff, who started for the bench. Renee, the clerk, beat him to it, disappearing behind the bench herself. In the next second, her scream split the air like an axe blade.
"He's dead!"
Ellen bolted from her chair and around the bench, where the clerk was on her knees, sobbing hysterically and pulling at Franken's robes.
"He's dead! Oh my God, he's dead!"
"Call an ambulance!" Ellen shouted, and the bailiff dashed into the judge's chambers.
As Ellen called out for someone to help with CPR, she was already tipping the judge's head back and feeling for a pulse.
"Has he got a pulse?" someone asked.
"No."
"Then let's have at it, Ms. North."
The voice registered with a jolt. She jerked her head up and saw Brooks positioning his hands over the judge's sternum.
"As much as I'd rather have you putting those lovely lips against mine," Brooks murmured, "I think the judge here has a more urgent need."
"He was a good judge," Ellen murmured as she stared out the window of Franken's chambers. The view overlooked the park and a sidewalk crowded with protesting college students. The imitation gas street lamps were winking on. Life was continuing. The world was still turning. The last hour was a blur of paramedics and people rushing in and out of the courtroom. Reporters loitering in the rotunda had stormed the courtroom for this latest twist in the tale, and a near riot had ensued when someone had recognized Brooks. The bedlam had culminated with a deputy clearing the room and the ears of the sound technicians with a shrieking bullhorn. The silence now seemed both welcome and odd. "He was tough and fair," Ellen said, her thoughts returning to Victor Franken. She wanted to remember him as she had known him for the past 2 years, not as a crumpled husk on the floor of his courtroom, the black robes he had prized so highly torn open to reveal the thin, sunken chest of a very old man. He had common sense and a sense of humor.
"Did you know him well?"
Jay asked softly. He watched her from his seat on the end of Franken's massive oak desk. They were the only people left in the room that had been the judge's office and sanctuary. Bookcases towered on all sides of the room, the shelves filled to capacity. The furniture looked so old, it might have set roots into the floor. The ferns that sat in massive pots all around the room were the size of bushel baskets. With the green-shaded desk lamp, the only light on, the atmosphere was almost forest-like. Ellen lifted a shoulder. "I know he lost his wife years ago. He lived alone. He liked to garden." She fingered the frond of a fern that filled the window ledge. "The bench was his life. And now he's gone. Just like that." She brushed a tear from her cheek, not embarrassed to have shed it in front of a stranger. A good man had just vanished from existence. There was no shame in mourning that. Still, she drew in a deep breath and composed herself, turning to Jay with a dignified facade. "Thank you for helping." He shook it off, frowning.
"I don't need thanks. Jesus, my being there turned the whole thing into a damn circus. I'm sorry that happened."
"So am I," Ellen said. "He deserved a more dignified passing. Although I heard him say it more than once. He wanted to die on the bench." She shrugged again and reached for some cynicism to insulate herself.
"He got his wish, and you got some publicity. Not a bad deal if you look at it that way."
"I didn't come here for publicity." "No, you came here for a story." He pushed himself away from the desk and crossed the room slowly, his gaze assessing, scrutinizing. The sensation it evoked was disturbing, but Ellen refused to let herself move away from it. From him. The rule she had applied with the sci-fi cowboys came back to her. Show no fear. Jay Butler Brooks posed no physical threat to her, but he was a threat in other ways, a clear and present danger on other levels. Professional. Ideological. She knew she was leaving one out as he stopped just a hair's breadth too close. His eyes were silver in the colorless light from the narrow window.
"Are you all right?"
he asked softly. Her hair had come loose from its twist as she'd worked to revive the judge. Strands fell along her cheeks, making him wonder how she would look with it all down. Younger, softer, vulnerable. Traits that didn't complement her professional image. But the image was slipping now. Her studious glasses were gone, along with a jacket of her charcoal suit. The top button of her proper white blouse was open, giving him a glimpse of the tender hollow where throat met collarbone. The armor was coming undone. She couldn't seem to decide who she should be in this moment. Ellen North, the consummate professional, or Ellen North, the woman. An opportune chance for him.
The reason he had hung around as the paramedics packed their things and zipped the black bag on old Franken, he told himself. So he could take advantage of her when she was off balance, so he might be able to catch a glimpse of something she never would have shown him otherwise.
What a guy you are, Brooks. Prince of the jerks.
I'm fine, she announced, though she clearly was not. The hand she raised to comb the loose strands behind her left ear was trembling.
Looks to me like you could use a drink. I know I could, he admitted. I never had a judge drop dead on me before, though I admit I wished it a few times.
That's right,